Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, we bring together voices from the publishing world for a 360-degree view of a book's journey from the manuscript phase to the hands of readers. Our panel talk through the process of finding an agent, submitting to publishers, and the editing process. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, find out how to avoid the slush pile, the pros and cons of indie publishing, and how the whole cycle works, from submission to bookshelf.
Okay, hello everyone. Hi. My name is Kasim Ali. I was an editor up until Friday, where I decided to throw it all in to go for the precarious life of being a full-time writer. And I'm an author too. And I'm here today to talk to Alexandra Pringle and John Mitchinson about the wonderful, wonderful world of publishing. I'm going to give them a tiny little introduction now. Please, I'm going to embarrass them a little bit, but they're incredible people.
We're embarrassed already.
Blushing under my beard here.
Well, at least it's under the beard. So John co-founded QI, have I got this correct, if I looked at your bio correctly, has founded Unbound?
Yeah.
Yes, which is an incredible, different sort of publisher, which we'll get onto in a couple of minutes, and has done a whole slate of things, including a podcast called Backlisted, which is about books, which is actually kind of cool. I listened to a couple of episodes, pretty good. And is currently working with Stephen Fry on, I believe, an Audible original podcast. Have I got that correct?
Yep.
So that's John. John, many hats. And then Alexandra Pringle, I've just learned, alongside her 23-year career at Bloomsbury, where she published one of my all-time favorite authors, Susanna Clarke, which I just fangirled about with Alexandra. If anyone has read her here, you've got taste. If anyone hasn't, please do. But has also worked at Hamish Hamilton, I believe, and was a literary agent of 4.5 years.
Yes.
And represented really small authors like Deborah Levy and Ali Smith, and is now working on a book of her own. So I think that'd be a really interesting thing.
I was the fourth person to join Virago Press.
Yeah. Which publishes...
Many years of my life.
Yeah, Margaret Atwood and many other brilliant writers. So we'll get on to the book writing, because I think it's so fascinating that you worked in publishing and now you're doing your own stuff, maybe towards the end. What we are going to do is like talk for around 45 minutes, and then we'll have like time at the end for Q&A for about 15 minutes. So there's going to be lots of questions because they're two incredible people and you want to ask them everything. So let's keep the questions brief. And if they're not brief, I'm going to cut you off because I want to give everyone a chance to ask as many as they want. So let's talk about getting published. Alexandra, I want to talk about literary agents because you were one for 4.5 years. But John, please come in because you also dealt with them. Really basic question. What is a literary agent? What do they do? Why do you need one? Do you need one?
You absolutely do need one. You need one nowadays. When I started in publishing, which was about 4 decades ago, it was possible not to have one. And indeed, the first novel I ever published when I was at Virago Press was Lucy Ellman's Sweet Desserts. And I just said to her one day, Lucy, why didn't you write a novel? And she said, oh, I might. And we did a contract direct with her and we bought world rights for £1,000 and it won the Guardian Fiction Prize. And yeah, it was a different world then, but you can't do that now. So a writer, the most important person in their life, actually on the whole, is their literary agent, because that's the person who looks after you and who is in a way responsible for your financial and your literary life. And you need to have a fantastic editor, but the editor has to marry the concerns of the needs of the author and the needs of the company. So whereas your literary agent has your back. And it's if you have the right literary agent, they know who to send your manuscript to in a way that if you're not in the business, you don't know. It's like a kind of dating agency. And if you don't know the taste of the editor, the kind of company, what their list is like, you're flying blind. And also nowadays, no one looks at a slush pile. And in the old days we used to, but technology has changed it because now we have email. Every editor gets... I used to get like 30 submissions a week, and you have almost no support for the reading. So if you're looking, and that's from literary agents. So if you're, you can't possibly look at the slush pile. So never think of just sending in unless you have a relationship, or unless it's a, and I think there are incredible small publishers nowadays, and they are slightly different in how they operate, but the kind of bigger publishers, you don't get looked at all.
And so this is where I kind of want to talk about Unbound a little bit, actually, because you have a very different sort of way of publishing. So I think to start off with, maybe let's talk about what Unbound is, and then we can get into how it works.
Yeah, we use crowdfunding. So we do publish quite a few unagented authors, although increasingly the authors we publish are agented, because for all the reasons that Alexandra said, but the idea of, we started Unbound as a way of trying to develop a more direct relationship between the author and the reader, because it seemed, I suppose, when we started 13 years ago, there were a lot of books that seemed to be good books that weren't finding a home. I think quite a lot has changed in the industry since then, which means, and one of the things that's happened is there has been a real flowering of very small independent publishers who mostly do a brilliant job at finding and developing new writers. But that remains still the way that we do. We have a crowdfunding model, which has developed over the years. We started on a very, very simple basis, which was that we had an opener submissions policy, which we still have, but I would say maybe one in 40 of those submissions gets looked at seriously. There is a massive, as Alexandra says, we still get about 200, maybe 200 to 300 on a really remarkable week, that degree of submissions. And we do look at them, but we look at them because we have there's a form that we can look at, so we can do it very, very quickly. We have a session, an afternoon session, where we go through, where we've pulled out, each of the commissioning team, there are four of us, will look at about, and honestly, most weeks there might be, I don't mean this to be depressing, but it's just the reality. Everybody wants to write a book. Why wouldn't you? It's brilliant. I mean, you know, something to give your friends and family. And I'll come on to what being published and why that's different from wanting to write a book. I think everybody should write. Everybody should join a creative writing class. Everybody should express themselves. There's a very different thing when it comes to getting other people to pay you for that work that you've produced. That's a different kind of, that requires a whole different set of conversations. And while often publishing, I think, is seen as a very hostile, difficult to get into place, some of that is true. I think there are ways around it now, that there are different ways of people finding ways of expressing themselves that don't require them to get a full scale book published, which is a lot of time, effort and energy, often for very little return. But so Unbound was really set up to be a way of, which we still are, we have a direct, I started as a bookseller, and I find it very, what I found really difficult about publishing was how distant I felt from readers. So most of what you do as a publisher is selling things to book retailers who are, you know, on one hand, global and mostly uninterested in what you have to offer, like Amazon, they'll sell anything but at a very high discount, to small independent bookshops who are brilliant, but that's a very wide range. What you're not doing is having those conversations, which I loved, which was, you know, read this, you'll love it, which I think is what everything in our industry boils down to. We are still, Alexandra and I are still discovering new authors and saying, we just had a conversation just before, my God, this is, book has completely blown my mind. That's what gets you up in the morning. It's not every day that you find that or you get to publish that, but reading, you don't have to be a publisher to be a great reader. The world needs more readers, more intelligent readers. That's the most important bit of the equation, frankly. So we started that. We have that direct relationship with our readers. We got about 400,000 people who buy and pitch into books. We offer a way of people getting signing sessions, meeting authors, going on day trips. There's all kinds of exciting ways that they can connect with the authors. We manage that process. And, you know, I think when I last looked, there are 650 books that we published over the last 13 years that might not exist if we hadn't set Unbound up. And some of them have genuinely come from, I mean, I'm just stressing, not very many have come completely from a completely kind of blind start, but some of them have come from there.
Sure. So in terms of the difference between Unbound traditional publishing, The idea with Unbound is that you raise the money from people, and then once you reach a figure, whatever that figure may be, then we publish.
Yes, except I would say that we have evolved the model a little bit now. Really, that raising the money from people works well if you've already got a network. It's really hopeless if you're a first-time writer and you've got fiction. So we started 4 years ago a thing called Unbound Firsts, which is where we choose two debut books by writers of colour and publish those without crowdfunding. And in fact, we're about to announce, although it hasn't been announced publicly, so keep this to you, we are going to be doing more, particularly fiction, without the need to crowdfund. We'd still like to keep all the fun pre-order stuff that we do, but it's very, very difficult to find and develop fiction in particular. Non-fiction, it's a bit easier. Often you've got a subject and you've got a group of people who connect to a subject, can. So we're not going to stop doing it crowdfunding, but it's got to the point where we are about 80% non-fiction. I love non-fiction, but I love fiction more. we've also had, so Unbound at first has been so successful, it's just reminded us of, it's crazy not to be opening your doors a little to, I mean, there's so many interesting writers out there. And our kind of rubric has always been to be as diverse as we can, finding unrepresented voices and trying to find a way of getting them in front of readers.
Sure.
So
I think.
But it is, yeah, there is a difference, I suppose. We've even now decided, because the way the industry works, profit share is complicated, difficult, causes more grief, honestly, than if we called it a cost share, it would be more honest. So we are paying small royalties, and we are paying small advances and royalties for some books as well now. So again, it's continually evolving, but the key to it is having that direct relationship with readers, which means we can send them stuff, which is great.
Okay. What I wanted to do was, I'm very aware of the fact that when people come to events like this, quite often we're talking about, how do you get a literary agent, right? You write a cover letter, you write a synopsis, you do your first three chapters, make sure that you're not calling a woman sir and all that kind of stuff, which is very good and very important. Please do not call women literary agents sir. Please do your research. But what I think people really want to know about, and what I think is really interesting, is actually what happens post-acquisition. So a submission has come in to the both of you, not the same one, but you bought the book, let's say it's a fiction one, and we both paid in advance, and it's following that sort of more traditional kind of publishing journey. What happens then? So Alexandra, let's start with you. You've just bought an author.
So I've actually bought it, because there's an awful lot you have to go through before you get to buy a book.
Well, let's talk about that for a little bit then. So let's say I've submitted you a book.
Yeah, so you're an agent.
Yes.
Okay, you're one of the top-notch agents.
Thank you so much.
And because I know you're an agent of taste and discernment, I look at the manuscript you submitted a little bit earlier than I might look at others, because I'm afraid life is like that. I would quite likely, when I was at Bloomsbury, I had one amazing woman who came in a couple of days a week to read for me, and I had my assistant, and the key to any good editor is that they have an amazing assistant. So you hire really high, you hire the brightest and the best, because they are your right hand, and they will often do reading, first read for you. So it's quite likely that someone will have had a look at it before, and they might have said, don't even bother, in which case you won't, because you want every reason, I'm afraid, not to publish, you know. If you've had a really excited response from a reader, like the reader that found me, Susanna Clark, and some of the best things that we published, Khalid Hosseini, and so on, you know that person knows you very well and what you love. So you get excited about a book, and then you have to take it to, in the old days, I was editor-in-chief at Bloomsbury for 20 of my 23 years. And while I was editor-in-chief, I had quite a lot of power. It didn't mean that I could take on everything I wanted, because you have to go through a process. But in those days, we called it the editorial meeting, and we all sat around the table, and there were lots of young people around as well, because I felt the kind of training of everyone was really important. Conversations were important. And you would submit, you would circulate this manuscript. So say it's a fiction manuscript, to your colleagues. And crucially, it's to people in sales, marketing, publicity, rights. Those are the sort of key, but particularly sales and marketing. And, you know, all the other editors, we'd all read each other's submissions. Then we'd take it to the editorial meeting. I would say, this book, this is why I love it, this is what I think could happen with it. If it needs work, you would say, I think this is the kind of work that needs to get it up to scratch, but I really believe in this talent. For example, there's someone called Samantha Shannon who wrote a fantasy. I'm not a fantasy editor at all, though I, you know, have Susanna Clarke, but I just thought this young woman is so talented. And it's a lot of sort of betting on people long term. It's not just that book, that particular book.
And to ask a question here, so at this point in the editorial meeting, you're not just thinking about the edits, you're also thinking about, if I have this correct, how to publish it.
You talk about that, and increasingly there are things that your colleagues in sales and marketing want you to deliver, which is, there is a word I absolutely loathe in publishing, and it's a non-word, it's comp.
I knew you were going to say that.
And everyone, you know, people say, what do you mean by comp? It means comparative title. So, you know, for example, if I were to describe the memoir I'm writing, because somebody asked me that when I was visiting publishers, it was being sold. And I was like, I can't think of my own comp. I have to think out what I'm writing is original, you know, hello. But, you know, say I was to say, oh, well, it's The Hare with the Amber Eyes crossed with Eat, Pray, Love. So that gives you a kind of idea of, you know, so that it gives the people in sales and marketing an easy pitch. And then they can also, and you make it for the books that have sold the biggest, you know, many millions of copies. Because you need them, the sales department, give you sales figures. So you discuss the book, and sometimes we would have rows. We would have really big arguments. And sometimes, even though I had quite a lot of power as editor-in-chief, I lost. But I often had to go into bat for my editors. So I would support them if they bought something. We'd already had a pre-editorial meeting to weed stuff out before. And nowadays, it's called an acquisition meeting. So it's an interesting linguistic twist. It goes from being an editorial meeting to an acquisition meeting. And if you think about that, it's actually very significant, very, very significant. So you have to have enough people also want to publish it and believe that they can sell enough copies to make it work financially, because it's bloody expensive publishing books. It costs many thousands of pounds. Even if the author is paid nothing, take away that, just the production of a book is incredibly expensive. So it's a big investment for anyone to make. And I think people don't understand that. It takes many hundreds of people to publish a book as well. You know, when you see a film, you're used to seeing a million credits. We could do that for books. It would be pages of lists of names, but we don't do that, you know. But it does take a lot of people. So then, say enough people want it, then the salespeople provide their figures that they project for the first 2 years' sales, which is how you assess what royalties to pay. And then you go to your boss, and in that case, it's not even like I wasn't the person that had the financial, it was the MD of the division. So then the boss looks at it and says, well, you know, you can, if you like, you can offer £5,000 for this book. It's like, and then if other people want the same book, it can develop into an auction. And everybody gets incredibly excited. This is another thing I don't love about publishing, is that I'm afraid there are editors that only feel that they are buying something worthwhile if other people want it. So if it becomes an auction, it becomes expensive, then this must be something worth buying. And more money is wasted that way than any other thing I can think of. And I used to, when I was at the Penguin Group at Hamish Hamilton, call this thing buy and dump, because you buy something at auction, get really overexcited, spend an embarrassing amount of money, and then you pretend you hadn't bought the book because you had a massive nerve loss afterwards. So, you know, because the thing about publishing is that none of us know what we're doing. We really do not know. We have our instincts. And what I feel about editors is actually all they have is their own taste. And it's just like John was saying, you know, you get lit up and when I'm reading a manuscript and I think I want to give it to this person and that person, then I know I'm onto something because I love it and I want to transmit it out into the world. That's my way of knowing. And the other thing that's a problem for young people, often if they don't have enough confidence in their own taste, is they start talking about the market, which is fine with nonfiction, because again, as John said, you kind of know who's going to buy most things. But with fiction, it's not, it's so weird. It's so mercurial. So then, you know, you make the offer to the agent and then the agent comes back to you. And if nobody else has offered, you know, you've got a good chance of getting it for a very, very small amount. So you have to go in quite low, hoping that, you know, you're not going to have competition. And the weird thing about that is it means nothing because, for example, a book that I bought that sold more than almost anything I've ever bought is Eat, Pray, Love by Elizabeth Gilbert. Nobody wanted it in the UK. I bought it for nothing. I bought it for £9,500 and it sold 3 million copies. So, you know, it just shows how insane the whole thing is. But if it had become an auction, I might have ended up paying £100,000. Who knows? You know?
Sure. So what happens, say, the submission that I've sent as the, you know, incredible agent I am. I sent it to both you and John. Both you and John want it.
Both want it. I make an offer.
You've made an offer.
He makes an offer.
I make a lower offer. Alexandra gets to publish the book. It's just...
If you're both competing, though, you have a beauty contest, don't you?
You do. And I mean, we founded Unbound really to try and not get into, because I could see this mad wastage thing that was happening, and books were going for hundreds of thousands of pounds that then sold, you know, fewer than 5,000 copies. I mean, actually 5,000 copies now is everybody's punching the air and saying we've got a success on our hands. Never underestimate how low sales can be for books. You would be shocked. You can get into the top 10 on some weeks of the year with fewer than 2,000 copies sold. So it's very different from music, very different from other things which sell lots of copies. As a, you know, that fast-moving consumer goods sector, I always call it books for slow-moving consumer goods. They mostly sit in bookshops and don't sell. But sometimes, obviously, they do, which is why we're all, as Alexandra says, second-guessing the market is really tricky. But what we would tend to do is to try and be not in that. And we also, because we're putting up the book on the site and having a sort of, you know, crowdfunding pre-order thing, we're getting some sense of the, what we were trying to do with that was to reduce the risk, because there is a huge amount of risk in publishing, because books, as you say, takes a lot of time. You've got to, you know, you overprinting, you know, there's a terrible statistic that says a quarter of all books that are printed in the UK each year are destroyed. It's, I mean, massively wasteful industry, because, you know, we all are very hopeful that our book that we love is going to be the one that sells. And sometimes it is, but mostly it isn't. So trying to figure out how to make a business out of that, and also to reward the author, you know, for the time, which frankly can't happen. You know, if you think how long it takes to write a book and you started to charge by the hour, you know, the average author, I think, in the UK earns, if you take out the top 5%, it's about 10 grand a year. It's wildly below the economic. So, yeah, don't give up the day job is what the first thing I say to everybody, even if you're talented.
I just gave up my day job.
I mean, it's so difficult. It's trying to be realistic about these things, because as I say, I passionately believe people that should write. The only way, you know, there are still so many stories that I feel don't get told. And they should be told and need to be told. And trying to navigate your way through this kind of difficult, I mean, you know, the publishing industry, we founded Unbound because we wanted to do something different. We wanted to try and find a different way, find a different way of getting books in front of people, which I think we have done. But you're still faced with the basic problems, which is, as Alexandra says, in the end, for a lot of stuff, you've only got your own taste. The whole thing about comps, the other thing which is you've probably seen is, because there's basically no review pages left in newspapers. When I was started, which is, you know, 38 years ago in books, there were large sections of newspapers devoted to book reviews. And book reviews, we at Waterstones in the early days, we put folders out where we cut all the reviews and put them at the front of the shop, and we put all the reviewed books. If you did that now, there'd be about 10 books with very, very tiny little... I mean, it's the whole... In fact, if you were an alien and you were tuned into our culture, you know, radio, television, you probably wouldn't infer that things like books existed at all. There's so little discussion about them. It's one of the reasons I started a podcast. So, you know, you're putting things out often now in quite small quantities. You'd be amazed to know how many copies of an average book Waterstones take now for their entire chain. You know, it's hundreds if you're lucky, very rarely thousands these days. So the chances are lottery already, but you can obviously go to Amazon and look and submit yourself to their spectacularly inaccurate, in my view, algorithms where they tell you if you like this, you'll like that. You know, it's always dangerous if you buy a book on some one subject that you need for a gift, and then you, the rest of your life, you're buying books on microwave cookery or something. But anyway, that's, leave my ranting on that subject aside. But the problem is bookshops, you know, if you find the book, is it the right book? So what you'll find is they're covered in quotes by other authors now. As we spend all our time sending a book out to say, will you give us a quote? Will you give us a... And it's kind of like madness. You think, I mean, not being rude about Stephen, but Jesus Christ, Stephen, you haven't read it. I mean, you're giving the same quote to about 15 different books, much as I love you, and I'm very pleased that you've given my book a quote. But is anybody fooled by this? Very occasionally, I saw a book once which I read entirely on the basis that it had a quote from Hilary Mantel and a quote from Martin Amis. I thought, that's got to be an intro. It was.
Hilary Mantel used to quote a lot. Martin
she did.
Didn't.
No, never.
She was rent a quote.
Yeah, I think he taught this writer at the University of Manchester, which is, anyway, it's a good book called The North Water by Ian.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, sorry. Turned into a TV show. I mean, sold, disappeared without trace as usual. But that's the other thing. So comps make a ridiculous comparison with a book that sold millions of copies that will fool no one, and find an author who you can lean on to say, my favourite was once Dick Cornby gave a quote which said, if you only read one book this year, make it this one. And the actual quote was, if you only read one book this year out of a grim sense of duty, make it this one. And they'd left that middle bit.
Oh, I'm very good at doing that. Yeah, doctoring the quote. Don't believe necessarily. Believe
so them. there is this kind of weird kind of, everything we do is surrounded by this weird miasma of desperation. But it is, you know, it is still the case that out of this miasma come amazing, life-changing things. I mean, we wouldn't do this if we didn't think that books really, really, really mattered. And occasionally, you know, a few of the books I've published in my career I have actually made them. And The Good Immigrant has now sold over 200,000 copies. It's a book that I think changed the way people thought. And that was, you know, that was at that moment nearly 10 years ago now. Nikesh couldn't get, he'd been sort of turned down. The idea of writing of a collection of essays by 21 writers of colour just wasn't something that anybody thought would sell. And it did sell. And then, you know, that's so it's, you know, trying to repeat those patterns, trying to find things that work. A lot of people spend a lot of time looking at the data and trying to figure things out.
And trying to do, it's that thing of if one book is published that's incredibly successful. You know, I published a nonfiction book called The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher, which was a Victorian detective story, real one, and it won the Bailey Gifford Prize, and it was incredibly successful. And then for about 5 years after that, there were a million lookalike books, all with the same kind of jacket. And then so the comp would have been, oh, it's like The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher. And it's like, please, just move on somewhere else, you know.
Well, we're sort of seeing this happen now with Sally Rooney, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, she's huge, 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 huge. And now I think, so I'm going to keep it quiet because I could talk about Sally Rooney for days. But a lot of young women are being published in the same way. They're being pushed in the same way, even if their books don't actually feel like Sally Rooney's writing, or they may be writing about different kinds of things or whatever it might be. So let's say you've bought the book. Now, what I'm really interested in is the editorial process, because you're now writing a book, and are you being edited by Canon Games?
I have an editor, but I haven't shown it to her yet. I'm going to get a complete first draft. It was sold on a proposal, although sure. I had written 20,000 words already. And I know that I would want her feedback. I think editors are so important. And I think often people don't realize quite what goes on behind the scenes, because editors are, you know, we keep ourselves back. It's not a conversation that's had very much. And what is interesting is that there are writers who always need quite a lot of editing, or want quite a lot of editing. And there are others that don't, but even the ones that don't have moments when they do need editing. So, for example, a writer I worked with for 20 years, Abdulrazak Ghana, who wrote some of the original novels about refugees and asylum seekers and so on, nobody cared. Nobody wanted to know 20 years ago. They just did not care. He's a beautiful writer. He had been shortlisted for the Booker Prize before he came to me at Bloomsbury. But some of his novels did need work, you know. So I always think that editing is a conversation between the writer and the editor. And what you do is you climb into the room of the book together and you talk about it and you push things around. And it's never an editor saying, you have to do this. It's not prescriptive. And I think a lot of people think, oh, the editor's going to change me. But it's not. It's saying, what if? Or I feel that perhaps this character could be developed more, or I've lost the sense of where the narrative is going, or whatever. And that's what we call structural editing. It's with the ideas of the book, the development. Tenses. I have said, like, to Will Sutcliffe, who wrote a YA novel about Palestine, it's like, try doing this in the present tense. I mean, maybe it was the past. I can't even remember now. I mean, he looked at me in absolute horror, went away, was really cross with me, had a go, and it worked, you know. Or there's another writer that I worked with recently, and she had four main characters, and I said, this one isn't working. Maybe kill her off before the action starts, before we enter the book, you know. And she looked like she wanted to kill me. But the interesting thing is, I did a conversation for the Women's Prize with Carmela Shamsie, who's a writer I worked with since she was a student in a university in upstate New York, and I was an agent, and I workshopped her story, and we kept in touch, and so I sold her first book, and then she came with me, and so we worked together for 30 years on every book of hers, and I used to edit her right, you know, from the beginning. But in this conversation, we said things to each other we'd never said before, and this was just like last year, and she said she would often, when she left an editorial session with me, if there was something that actually made her quite angry, she used to have to go and sit on it for a few days, and they were often the things that were the most important. But she needed time to absorb them, and that she now realizes that if she was upset, it's because it hit home. So that's what I mean about it's a conversation. And then very often you might suggest something to an author and they say, no, you know, that doesn't work for me. And it's their work, it's their world, it's their words. And I think that's incredibly important. And to be very, very respectful of it. And you wouldn't be working with an author if you didn't believe in that author and have huge respect for them. So that's really at the sort of center of that process. And then there are other sorts of editing, which is the line editing, the copy editing. I'm completely uninterested in that. And the other thing is that there is a difference, don't you think, between American editors and UK editors. American editors are much more intrusive. They literally do go through the sentences and change things around. I don't believe in doing that. I believe in really respecting the author's use of language and the way they do things. And one of the things I love about novels is they are always imperfect, the great imperfection of books. You know, look at Dickens. You couldn't say that everything about a Dickens novel works. You know, there are always like longers and rambling bits and all the rest of it. But if it works for you, it doesn't. You don't have to be. You don't have to drill down into why it works. But American editors like to imprint themselves much more on the text than UK editors. It might partly be because UK editors, we have a smaller market. So I used to edit 20 to 25 books a year, run a department, go to New York, set up the company in India. Completely insane, you know. An American editor might edit 5 books in a year. They have a lot of time to spend with the text, you know, because they've got a bigger market.
So, John, you've written books. You've written the QI books. So what I'm really interested in is, does that impact the way that you approach your relationship with your authors, having been an author? And I'm really interested to know, we'll come back to you, Alexandra, how you feel now being on the other side of the relationship.
Well, yes, in that I love being edited. I mean, as somebody who edits, and Alexandra's description of that process is exactly what it's like. You're trying to find the best way of the author to express what is their story or their language. And often it's just, there are bits in all books where you can see I mean, I've been working on a very good writer at the moment, but his concentration, you can see where his concentration has slipped, and you just, what is this scene for? I don't know. I just thought it'd be fun. So yeah, it's not really helping us to get to the next bit of the book. Oh, yeah, you're right. Well, take it out. So that, you know, that's some, but other times, as you say, so for me, it's like that. I love the, anyone who's ever written knows that it is this strange, you have a clear idea of what you want to say, but language, the making of the language is, you always feel that you're never quite pinning it down. So whatever you deliver, I'm always, I love that thing where you get the feedback and you, I mean, I'm always a bit suspicious of editors. I was once told by a well-known London editor, it's actually quite good advice. It's just said, it's easy. You want them to think you're a genius. Just tell them to lose the first chapter and take out all their adverbs.
And actually, yes, and it, adverbs.
And it actually, it's kind of, say, oh my God, thank
take
you.
Take the adverbs out.
Yeah, always. There's never really any justification. And usually the first chapter, you can feel them straining to try and make something that's going to really grab you by the lapels. No, just get into the story, for God's sake. So I love being edited. Has it changed? Yeah, I think reading is so important. I think if you're, and it's one of the great problems, right, for editors, you're reading shit most of the time. You're not reading great literature.
Oh, my God, yes. So your standards descend.
You're reading this stuff, and you, anything that's even halfway, you know, decent, you know, oh, my God, a genius.
Work of genius.
And you think, oh, no. No,
I know.
Hang on. And then you go and read a kind of an Ali Smith novel, and you think, oh my God, yes, that's so. It's one of the reasons I love doing the podcast, because I'm forced to read a lot of great stuff that I might not.
And they're old books as well.
Old books, which are the best, honestly.
Stood
the test of time.
I always used to think that when I was editor in chief, that I couldn't do it. But to say to editors once a year, they should go away for a week just to read classics and read, you know, and
the
so
old
that
idea
then they
of a
would
reading
like
week, yeah.
get their and then get their standards back up again, because it's terrible, that sinking of standards.
I mean, so working with somebody, and I think that process is. Alexandra, there's no author that isn't improved by working with a good editor. But it is it's a very complicated, delicate relationship, and which can go horribly wrong. I mean, if you look at some of the famous, I mean, there was an editor in America called Gordon Lish who, it's now famously, kind of massively controversial whether Raymond Carver's stories were by Raymond Carver or by Gordon Lish. Because there was so much, a famous editor who Alexandra knows, who I work with, Christopher McElhose. I mean, I think I can tell this story because I suspect Gerald Seymour is dead. He used to get Gerald Seymour to triple space all his manuscripts. And then he would literally rewrite the prose. And so, I mean, that's the most extreme form of editing that I know. But usually there is a kind of, I mean, you see something in a writer that you like, and then you see them kind of losing their way, and you're trying to bring them back. And as Alexandra says, but in the end, sometimes I've published books that have gone out there and I've just thought, that is still going to really annoy me forever. And the book has done really well and nobody else seems to notice or care. You think, what is the point, frankly? I think that's underappreciated, how much work, again, talking about, you know, economics, the amount of time, really, you don't do your editing. Did you do your editing at work?
Never.
You
don't
did it
have
at weekends.
Time.
You do it in your evenings.
Yeah.
You do it.
Yeah.
It's. Yeah. And it's a
7-day a week job being an editor, because you do your editing in the time that, and it's also like often you have to go out, you have to go to book launches, bookshop readings, and so on.
It's
so you
hell.
Have that kind
it's
of,
absolute hell, I tell you.
It's a sad life.
It's driven by sort of, I mean, it's obviously, it's, you know, we love it, really.
Yeah.
But it's also this thing of, there is something that is so exciting about, still, I love the physical. You know, when you remember somebody sent you some messy manuscript, or you had a conversation on a train, and then 2 years later, there is this thing sitting in front of you on the desk.
It's wonderful.
That is kind of like a, Yeah, I mean, it's like somebody has pulled a bit of themselves out and turned it into something out there in the world. It's a very humbling job, really, because as Alexandra says, it's not your book, but you feel your experience and skill, such as it is, has helped that happen.
Yeah, you're the midwife.
Yeah.
But being on the other side
is
completely fascinating in ways I would never have thought. And the interesting, so I started writing literally a year ago in France. I was in France for 2 months and I got up at 6 a.m. and put on my dressing gown, didn't even brush my teeth, and just went down and sat on a balcony and started writing. But I kind of started, because I'm writing a memoir, by using Instagram, which I love, just by putting little posts up with the family photograph or something, a reminiscence, and having the lovely kind of dialogue with the people who read it and feeling, there's something there. And so I think Instagram and the Substack and all sorts of ways, there are so many good ways now that you can write, other ways you can write. But anyway, but it was a secret when I was writing in the summer. I had to tell my husband, unfortunately, but I did have to tell him. But my son didn't know, my stepdaughter didn't know, who's actually a Sunday Times best-selling memoirist herself, called Clover Stroud. And, you know, I had friends staying in this house and they'd come down the one saying, what are you doing? And I'd say, I've got this little company called Silk Road Slippers and I teach writing masterclasses in Marrakesh and I'm going to do one in London as well with my colleagues. So I'm still editing, I'm teaching. So I still have that as part of my life. But then the writing, it was like having a secret affair. I'm not saying I've ever had a secret affair, of course, but, you know, the excitement of this relationship with what I was doing was absolutely thrilling. And then I got an agent after Christmas this year, and I chose completely the opposite kind of agent I thought I would have chosen, which was very interesting. I thought I would want somebody a little bit like me, rather nurturing, you know, taking lots of care, having loads of conversation. There, I decided I wanted a cowboy. I wanted a buccaneer. And I went to a man who I used to have regular arguments with when I was a publisher, David Godwin. And he was exactly what I wanted. So that's the other thing is, you know, how you find your way is what kind of an agent you want. But all the things I used to laugh at, I have to say, then it became an auction, which was deeply shocking. I thought maybe one person might want to pay £1,000 for it. And then the next thing is the whole thing went completely insane. And I was teaching in Morocco, teaching this writing, and I grew a sty on one eye and then a sty on the other eye with the trauma. And I had to teach for 2 weeks with no eye makeup on. So I just want you to feel very sorry for me because it's like the worst thing that I can imagine in life. And then I had the deal, and then it was announced, you know, in the bookseller. It was the London Book Fair. You know, there was a preempt came in from America, and the whole thing was insane. And then I froze, and I thought, oh, my God, I can't do this. You know, I had this big advance. I thought, how can I write something that's going to be worth this amount? You know, and I went into total meltdown, and I'm only just climbing out of it, and I'm about to go off to France to get back into it properly, but I went into sort of trauma. And then there are just a couple of like small things that I used to laugh at authors for. One is, why do they talk about not being able to write at home? I mean, come on, you know, what do you mean you can't write at home? And in some cases, people had very nice sized houses with different rooms. Why didn't you just go into a different room? I live on a boat, so I don't have that. But nevertheless, I just, you know, had no time. I so understand that. I can't bear working at home. I can do lots of work at home, but I can't write at home unless I get up like at 5 a.m. and do it secretly in the dark when nobody's around. So is that, and the other thing that writers are always obsessed with is how many words they've written a day. And I just like, why, who cares? It just matters what the words are like. And, you know, and anyway, getting out a first draft, you know, there are many things I can say about all of that, but I would just laugh at them and I've become completely obsessed. And I would just like say to my husband, I've written 678 words today. He just looks at me, he's a writer, look at me pityingly.
It's weird. Yes.
And you lose yourself. I completely forget who I was as a publisher. And indeed, when I had an agent, I wanted him to do everything. I didn't want to make any decisions. I thought I would want to be really involved because I know everything about the publishing world. And it's like we had this meeting and he said, I want you to write a proposal. I said, oh, do you? How long should it be? As if I hadn't read 5 million proposals in the last 4 decades. You know, when would you like it by? I became this child. I was really shocked at myself, but, you know, that's what happened.
Just learning the complete opposite side of everything.
Yeah. I had to switch into another bit of my brain 100%.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. They're definitely different, completely different, the writing. I know it was a great bit of advice somebody gave me from, like, he said, for your own writing, have a different identity on your computer. So instead of logging on, you know, with your usual shit with all your emails, you have a completely separate one, which has got no email, no...
Just a Word document.
It's just like, more than a Word document, completely, instead of having a guest identity, you have your writer identity and you...
I see.
It actually does kind of work.
Shifts you into a difference.
You forget who you're... You forget the work, because if you're spending your time having these conversations, but the bit of you at 5 in the morning that's trying to do that is not the same you that's sitting in meetings telling people why this is the greatest novel you've ever read.
Yeah. And one interesting thing that I found is it's hard to pitch your own book. It's hard to talk about your own book. I could pitch all of my author's books.
It's one of the things we teach on our masterclass. We start with getting people to write a blurb about their book, and then at the end of the week, we get them to rewrite it and read it out. And it's amazing what happens in that week, because it's very hard, and we can help them. They often, the writers pin it up on their, they pin up what they've done by the end of the week in front of them to help them through what they're doing.
To remind yourself.
It's one of the reasons that we did the podcast. We usually get writers to come on and talk about other books. I mean, if you get... Some writers can talk well about their own work, but in general, if you want a writer to really open up, get them to talk about a book that influenced them or that they love, and you'll almost learn more about them than you would if they were saying...
Yeah. Completely.
I can't really remember why I wrote this novel now, or if I knew what it was about, I wouldn't have to write it, which is kind of true.
His podcast is wonderful, by the way. Recommend it.
The podcast is great.
Alexandra has been a guest on it twice.
Twice, yes.
So what we're going to do now, I'm really sorry we have less time than I wanted, but it's been a great conversation. It's been a great conversation. Questions. Does anyone have any questions? Oh, someone at the back.
Hi, thanks very much for speaking. I'm probably like most people, not even started, but I'm daunted by the whole getting, not the writing bit, as in that's daunting in itself, but how the heck do I get from writing a couple of chapters to getting to you guys? And I know that obviously you've talked about agents and things, but it's just practicalities, like, you know, some people will say you need a chapter or two.
It depends. Is it fiction or non-fiction?
Non-fiction.
Okay.
Yeah, probably. Yes. In a way, nonfiction is easier. You can probably do a synopsis and a couple of chapters.
Yes.
What I would say is, if you don't already have a copy of the Writers and Artists Handbook, really study publishers, study agents, try and look at what they're... Honestly, so much time is wasted by people writing to the wrong kind of people. Go and find all the books that you feel are... in the same rough area that your book is, and look at who's published them.
And who agented them.
And then look inside. Do as much research as you can. I never like being negative about it. I mean, it is a difficult process, but it's a difficult process for a reason, because there are 100,000 books published every year. Most of them don't sell very many copies.
Yeah. The woman with the glasses, yes. Sorry, she had her hand up before.
Oh, yes. Thank you very much. Actually, my question is related to the one that was just asked. But, the first thing you said was about the need for a literary agent. How on earth do you find one of these?
Yeah, well...
Where do they hang out?
Well...
In the Writers and Artists Yearbook, there's a list of all the literary agents.
And they'll give, in that excellent publication, which I'm guessing is probably online as well now, you'll see what they specialize in, the authors that they represent. I can't stress enough that time spent looking and thinking, it may well be that you don't you know, you probably can contact a lot of them without getting much or any response. But I mean, there is a whole other thing that we haven't talked about, because in a way we're probably not qualified to talk about it, but self-publishing is a thing now.
Yeah.
All I would say is self-publishing is the same problem as traditional publishing, or what I do is that there's a hell of a lot of books out there, and most of them, I think somebody I saw recently, it was less than £200 the average self-published author earns a year. You know, there are people who do brilliantly. Again, planning, preparation, really trying to figure out why you're writing and what you're writing for, and whether it's if it's for your own, you know, as it were, if there are all kinds of good therapeutic reasons, if it's for sharing stories with people, you join a writing group, so get as many people as possible who you trust or possibly don't trust to give you feedback on your work. That sooner or later, you know, you're going to have to, somebody's going to say, is this worth 10 quid of my time? I'm not just 10 quid, but like, you know, 3 to 8 hours of their reading time.
Yeah.
So it's a big ask.
I think being in a writing community is incredibly valuable. And there are also lots of very good online courses, lots of local colleges that have creative writing groups, and having sort of access to other people is so beneficial. And, you know, it's difficult to find an agent. It really is. So you have to have your work the best possible way that you can get, you have to get it as good as you possibly can before you try and find an agent. And you have to think very carefully about your submission email to them and how you describe your work and who you are. And also, if you've had stuff published in any way, that will help. If there's anything to back you up, if you've done an MA in creative writing, and also, if you haven't, always think of that, because there are lots of really good courses now and agents will go to them to find talent. So it's quite a good way to be found, is if you're in one of those creative writing courses. But you know, you have to really, really work on what you're doing, because people don't have the time. Everyone is swamped with material, you know.
My question is a bit off tangent. You alluded to the fact that most of the books that you read now, the great books, they're old, they stand the test of time and so on, and also that the standards were falling. Do you think reading is a dying art, and how worried are you?
No. Do you?
Genuinely, I don't know. No. I think actually, usually the people who tell me that reading's a dying art are people at middle-class dinner parties, and you say, kids are not reading anymore. And you say, well, your kid's reading. Yeah, I say, well, my kids are reading, but my, you know, it's like there are loads of other people. I mean, if you look at the statistics, more people are buying more books across a greater range of subjects than ever before.
Yeah.
There are issues particularly with boys during the teenage years. Boys tend to, there's a period where boys stop reading and then some of them come back and others don't. I mean, there are all kinds of issues around literacy. There is, I have to say, you know, an education system that seems to have been completely moved away from the humanities towards STEM subjects in a way that I think is dramatically damaging to our culture and our. But there is still, you know, I think it's fascinating to me. Everybody thought that kids were going to become completely screen based and that their reading would take place on ebooks. Actually, it turns out that if you look at BookTok now, there's a huge explosion.
It's unbelievable. So I published this novel called The Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller, and it did incredibly well. It won the Women's Prize and we were thrilled. But then 10 years after we published it, these kids, teenage kids, discovered it, put up videos of themselves finishing the book, crying and crying and crying. And we went on, we've sold 2 million copies of that book, and it's all kids reading it and kids posting on BookTok. And so that just shows you something. This is a really beautiful novel by a classicist about a Greek myth, which is also a gay love story. And this thing happened on its own. It wasn't the publishers doing that. It was discovered, and it just shows the absolute joy in reading that's out there.
I think there is challenge in terms of time, and there's been a massive explosion in content on cross across all sorts of the streaming channels. What I find is when I talk to groups of younger people now is that they are really quite much more sharp on narrative than, you know, say my generation would have been, because they all see how the long form dramas are being manipulated, and there's a more of an articulacy about that. Doesn't also necessarily mean that the stuff is always going to last. If I said that I meant the point about standards falling, I think there's more amazing books being published. There's just as many. There are very. It doesn't matter however many books get published. The numbers of books that kind of will last always seem to, you know, great books. There's a huge market at the moment in rediscovery, which one of the things we do on the podcast is books from 50 years ago that suddenly get rediscovered by a new audience.
And which is what going, I did at Virago, because I edited the Modern Classics series for 10 years.
I mean, so you know. I have to be, I suppose, you know, we have to be cultural optimists. And I just, you know, politically, I think there are challenges. Economically, there are challenges. But I think reading is one of the, it is still the most extraordinary thing. And the people who read have got twice the life of people who don't read, twice the number of places to go, twice the number of people to share their lives with. You know, fictional characters don't let you down.
And on that note, I'm so sorry, we kind of have to... Do we have time, Rose?
Quick.
Okay, very quick.
How do you know what is the best route as an author of fiction to getting your book distributed?
Do you mean if you've self-published it? Well, sorry, I mean
self-publishing versus traditional publishing. I've got two books on the go now. At least one of them has made it out of its first draft, technically second. I come from like a video games background. That's where my degree was in. And, you know, my stupid plan was to just throw it up on itch.io for free because I'm scared of, you know, people actually like paying money and being disappointed by my writing. I was just wondering if that was a good idea.
Well, it's not a terrible idea as long as you're prepared to, you know, that it's who's going to read it. If you've got a group of people who you think would read it and give you great feedback, it's that's not a bad route at all. And a video games background, I've published quite a few people with video games backgrounds on that. We've got quite a geeky list. That crossover is an interesting one. So my advice is always to keep going and keep trying. It's like a Rubik's Cube. Try different things. Put it up for free. If that doesn't work, try and find an agent. If you can't find an agent, you know, do a Substack account. Publish it in serial form doing that.
Substack's great.
There's so it's much really now good. That there's no problem about getting it out there. The problem is getting people to read it is the challenge. Did you have a question at the front?
Could you each say two titles of books that you believe are important?
Oh, my God. Okay, I'll come up with one that I've read recently, because you can remember what you've read recently, which is Hisham Attar's new novel, which is called Best Friends or something. Yeah. I can't remember what it's called, which I think is a masterpiece. It's the most beautiful novel about exile. So
and
that's
just won the Orwell Pulitzer Prize.
It won the Orwell Prize, yeah.
Me, I would deeply recommend Susanna Clarke's Pur and Essay, which I've been thinking about this entire time. It's a brilliant, brilliant book, even if you don't like fantasy.
That's a brilliant novel. Weirdly, because I've been listening to Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer, which is a book about, she's a botanist, but also a Native American. I have to say, it's absolutely enchanting. And if you want a book about climate change and building a more robust and intelligent relationship with nature, it's great. So,
and on that, sorry, round of applause for Alexandra and John, and we're done.
Thank you for listening. The 2025 Bradford Literature Festival programme is now live. Visit bradfordlitfest.co.uk to discover the huge range of events on offer over 10 days from the 27th of June. Don't miss out. Book your tickets now.